You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Available now at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite bookseller. Publishers Weekly calls Get Scrappy a helpful digital marketing Bible. You can read the first chapter, get special digital extras, and learn more now at GetScrappyBook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Nicholas Webb. Nicholas is a world-renowned technology futurist innovator. As an inventor, Nicholas invented one of the first wearable technologies and one of the world's smallest medical implants. Nicholas has been awarded over 45 patents by the U.S. Patent Office. Nicholas is the author of several best-selling books, including The Innovation Playbook, and has recently released number one best-selling book, What Customers Crave. As the CEO at Crave, Nick works with some of the top brands in the world to help them lead their market in enterprise strategy, technology, and innovation. Nicholas has been awarded with his Doctorate of Humane Letters by Western University of Health Sciences, a top Southern California medical school, for his contributions in healthcare technology. Nicholas, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You know, I, being a Nick myself, in the middle of your bio, I turned you into a Nick too, and realizing I had forgotten to ask to do so. So I am a Nicholas that is never Nicholas and really only Nick. Mostly yeah. Because my last name is sort of the opposite of yours, though they share the first two letters, but it's about four times as long. So I figure I got to keep the short name or the first name short.
Right. So. It's all about branding, right? So, I mean, if it takes a global positioning satellite to pronounce your name, right, then chances are it's not a good brand. Yeah. I find that Nicholas tends to be when I'm in trouble, right? Nicholas.
Right. That's why it scares me, I think. So, but apologies for inadvertently.
I go by either.
So your bio, speaking of branding, it has some great little simple lessons in it, in that it invites curiosity. So before we talk about what customers crave and branding and everything else, I have to know about the one of the first wearable technologies and the world's smallest they weren't the same thing, were they? Was it one
That
was both of those? I suppose it couldn't be, though you are kind of wearing an implant on the inside, but
yeah, right. Yeah, so the wearable technology, you know, I identified 20 years ago the ability to leverage digital connectivity as a way to monitor patients to improve and increase their quality of life. And primarily the idea was to be able to make certain that patients were complying to a pharmacological regimen. So prior to the internet, because I would have loved to have had that toolbox at ready in my last innovation, what I only had to work with was two-way radio pagers. So I developed a computer program that allowed doctors, when they checked out a patient that was on, you know, sort of life-critical medicines, to send them out a beep, and then they would respond on this two-way pager to confirm that they have in fact taken their medicine. And if they didn't take their medicine, there was a range of things in this algorithm to make sure that that didn't happen. And so that was really the first, one of the first digital wearable technologies. Today, of course, and we have a new project called the Destruction Lab. And in our Destruction Lab, we're working on wearable technologies that have stacked layered sensors that are spewing out as much as 30 biodata points to be able to really monitor patients as a contiguous data node so that we can anticipate problems before they become acute. So been in at the wearable space for a long time. It's a lot of fun and continues to evolve. The world's smallest medical implant, one of the world's smallest medical implants, is a microsilicone implant that goes into the punctal opening of the vertical puncta. So in your eye, if you look at your eye in the inside corner and you roll your lid down, you'll see that there's a little tiny hole there. And that hole is actually a drain, so that when your lacrimal, your lids produce too much fluids, or if you have reactive tearing or any kind of tearing, it kind of gives you a chance to drain that off the eye without it draining down your face. That's the idea of the puncta. But I invented a plug, a little insert that goes there that has a flexible shaft, so it complies to the anatomical structure of the vertical puncta, so that it doesn't inadvertently pop out. And that, I think, it's one of the most popular to this day, one of the most popular ways of treating ocular surface disease.
That is amazing. And I have to ask, as I'm sitting here thinking about your background, you know, most of us marketers are hacks. You have a pretty impressive pedigree. What brings you to branding, customer service, marketing, from where you've been?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, I spent the best part of my life, or the majority of my life, I should say, inventing bright, shiny objects. And that's been really, really fun. But then came the uberfication of everything, right? So the medium by which we invent and the stuff that we invent has changed drastically over the last 3 to 4 years. And it turns out that the future for organizations and for entrepreneurs and for brand managers to really win is to leverage innovation methodologies in the way in which they design perfect human experiences. So I got interested about 3 years ago when I started this body of research to say, gee, we've gotten really good at developing systems and methods and processes and tools and technology stacks to invent great technologies. What if we applied a design approach towards the way in which we invented perfect human experiences, like Apple has, like Trader Joe's has, like In-N-Out Burger has, and these other great brands? What if we did that? And it got really interesting to me, and it became really clear that the single best marketing tool and the single best brand tool was applying innovation methods to customer experience design.
So what are some of those innovation methods?
Well, in the good old days of marketing 101, we were taught to look at customers across a range of market demography: age, gender, socioeconomic, regionality, you know, whatever. Right? We looked at them in kind of, as my 18-year-old daughter would say, lame ways. Right? They were lame. Because the truth of the matter is that if you were to use market demographic to manage a brand and to manage your marketing initiative, you would have to look at it this way. Like, where I went to school, pretty much every kid was a, you know, somewhat affluent white kid, right? So my high school looked like the same people. We were a single market demographic socioeconomically. We obviously had a couple flavors of gender, but we had, for the most part, a monolithic market demographic. If I were using old-fashioned demography, I would market to my high school class very much the same way, to everybody in that class. Makes sense, and that's what we've done for years. But the great brands have begun to realize that, wait a minute, that's not really who we are. We are a range of nodes, and these nodes are built up based on one simple concept: what we hate and what we love. Where I went to school in Southern California, they were the skateboard kids. They were the surfer kids. They were the stoner kids. They were the band geeks. They were the geeks. They were the jocks. They were the cheerleaders, right? We could break those down into these demographics that had more to do, not so much with these traditional demography, but what they really hated and what they loved. And the best brands have begun to figure that out, that if we can identify our personas, not based on demographics, but based on that simple concept of what is this group of customers hate and love, then we can use innovation best practice to invent perfect experiences that are above the customer's baseline level of expectation across 5 simple to understand and well-defined touch points in both digital and non-digital channels. That's the secret, and that's what I talk about in the book, those principles: blended experiences in digital and non-digital channels, understanding these simple five customer touch points and getting very, very different about the way in which we leverage the insights to understand what our customer personas really are.
And the ones that, as you note, have that figured out are the, you know, your Apples, your Trader Joe's, who we think about, who we talk a lot about, but it doesn't always seem like we've necessarily cracked the code for how to create that, how to get beyond, you know, some of the basics like you were talking about with demography. So if I'm a business that kind of knows who my customer is by demographic, how can I translate that into finding which nodes make the most sense?
Well, you can use it as a baseline, but sometimes it's better to forget about it altogether. Let me give you an example. So you go to the Apple store, which is the most, and the reason I know Apple's overused, but let's not forget the fact that they're the most profitable business on the planet and they're the most successful retailer on the planet. So let's learn the way of the Apple, right?
That's the way of saying to folks out there, apologies that you have to hear about them so much, but they do a great deal right. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
sorry if you've heard of Apple.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, I don't know. It's sort of like the Uber scenario. People talk about Uber all the time, but I think most people don't understand what Uberfication really is. And I don't think that people really understand the secret sauce. And what Apple, when you think about Apple's genesis, and I am a technology geek. I mean, I don't work out of an office. I work out of a lab. And in my lab, I got, you know, 3D printers and the latest drones and Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and digital scanners and CNC mills. And, you know, I work out of a technology lab. This is my religion. And I can tell you that there, when you look at Apple, Apple began to be successful by taking the uber complexity of computing and turning it into, as my 10-year-old daughter would say, delicious experiences. These delicious experiences were in the form of an icon. I can remember having to learn DOS to be able to get my dot matrix printer to print something, right? So we went from, you know, these computers where you had to write code in order to get anything to happen, to Apple coming out with these iconic symbiology, these little delicious images that you click and they do things that are amazing. So the UX design, the user experience was amazing. Well, what Apple has done in everything that they've done is that they have used UX, the magic of user experience design, and applied it to their retail environment. So when you go to an Apple store, the first thing that they do is they greet you. There's plenty of people working there because Apple realized that the one thing that all node types hate is waiting. And people say, how is it possible that there's 40 people working in an Apple store? I mean, how do they afford to staff it that way? The bigger question is that how do other major retailers not staff it that way when they see people looking at stuff on the shelf? They're saying that some of the biggest national brands, these national electronic retailers, they're saying that they're the showroom for Amazon. We don't want to be the showroom for Amazon. We want to sell people while they're there. But the first thing that they do in that first touch point is that they politely probe you. They're not probing to sell you anything. They're not trying to find out what your demography is. They want to understand your persona or your node. Now, I am a transactionalist, meaning that I know the Apple product extremely well. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I just want to get in, get my stuff, and get out of there. I mean, I'm busy. I'm not lonely. I want my stuff. And so when I go to the Apple store, they instantly identify, he's that guy. Okay. Hey, listen, Nick, download our free app. Go scan whatever you want on the wall and get out of here. Or I'll be glad to take your card and ring you up right here and get it for you. So they understand speed is really important to me. I don't need to be educated and I don't need to be nurtured. My wife, on the other hand, is a nurturing node type. She needs to be immersed in something in order for her to be engaged, in order for her to make a purchase. So they realized that they also had to understand that node type, not by demographics, by what she hates and what she loves, and then to pre-invent a perfect experience for her. And once they identified that she was a nurturing node type, they take her to the Genius Bar and they hang out and they go on Pinterest and they show her how to put her family photos together. And they just immerse in stuff that matters to her, not about the technology, not about the bright shiny object, but about the human experience, which they're so good at. And my wife leaves with buckets of their stuff every time. So organizations that can be more thoughtful about understanding these personas and then invent. There's another thing I talk about in the book that I call the customer value strata. And this is important because the overwhelming majority of companies live at what I call the baseline level of customer expectation. And that means the company's giving the customer what they expected. And below the baseline level of customer expectation are things like what I call the criminal level. And we've all been there. You go to a restaurant, they serve you bad food in a bad environment with a cranky server, and then they charge you, they do a $60 cashectomy on you, right? And so that's what criminals do, right? They take something from us, a value, and they give us pain in return. How many of those kinds of customer experiences have we all had? And those are the companies that are dead. They're just a matter of time. But what's interesting in this, as I was researching this, I found that organizations that were giving the customers what they wanted routinely were failing routinely because the experience was not remarkable. And I mean remarkable literally. Nobody remarked on the experience. And so they didn't leverage the power of hyper-influential social networks, and they didn't create these brand advocates. They were creating madvocates. And I think that when we look at understanding these nodes and we get really thoughtful about what a perfect experience is across these personas at each of these five touch points, then and only then do we get to predictably win a customer experience.
I love the label of madvocates. That says in a much more succinct way, you know, what so many talk about that makes sense on your strata there, that angry person's going to go tell the world and going to create all kinds of problems at all ends. So you need to manage up and exceed, you know, beyond that baseline that most of us kind of tread water at.
Right.
Kind of mixed metaphors there. I'm not sure if we were treading water or at a baseline or climbing something. So does it make sense to dive in and talk a bit about those five touch points or the blended experience, the online, offline? What comes first?
Well, I think they're both very important. I think that, you know, different businesses and different markets have different blends. But the first or the pre-touch moment is usually almost exclusively a digital one. Google now calls these micro mobile moments. And these micro mobile moments are leveraging digital ubiquity to, we are literally contiguously connected to a supercomputer that has all the information in the world. So we've learned that if we can go to our connected devices, we can command anything to us. And that is so powerful, in fact, that 97% of the time that a consumer is looking for anything, they start their search in this pre-touch moment. And I call it the pre-touch because they haven't engaged us yet. They haven't called us. They've gone to our website, perhaps, or they've looked us up on social channels, or they've done reputation checking on TripAdvisor or Yelp or Google ratings or Amazon or whatever. But they haven't really engaged us directly. So we do have control of this pre-touch moment, but not we only have control of it indirectly. And by that, I mean We have to be good at our core experiences if we want people to like us so that pre-touch moment looks good. We do have some additional control in our digital side. Jay Baer wrote a great book, Utility, probably familiar with it.
Yes.
And as much as I believe in content marketing, I think that content marketing, to sound like one of my teenage kids, was so 2013, right? What we really have to do today is go beyond content marketing, and we have to do gratuitous marketing. And gratuitous marketing means that our digital properties are absolutely total value dispensers. They are just creating constantly value, not just good content, but other kinds of dynamic, real, meaningful value. If you're an air conditioning company, you need to have a well-defined full book, an audio series on the 10 things that every consumer needs to know before they buy an air conditioning, and give them not propaganda, but give them real information to help them make a good decision. And if you do that well, then maybe you deserve the right to do business with them. But if you don't do it at all, don't expect that business. So pre-touch is about delivering value prior to them first engaging you. Now, sometimes I took a picture of a restaurant yesterday, and it was Mexican American Asian restaurant. Like, wow. And we know that, as Brian Tracy says, the universe loves a specialist. My guess is that none of those were very good. But I guess at one point they decided that they weren't going to sell Asian food anymore. So what did they do? Well, I mean, obviously, they got duct tape. And they duct taped over the word Asian. Right? So that's a pre-touch moment. That is a pre-touch. Anything, everything I would ever need to know about the cleanliness of their kitchen, the quality of their service, or that human restaurant experience was beautifully displayed in the pre-touch moment of the duct tape over the Asian word in their sign, right? Because quality is a systemic thing, or at least we perceive it as that. Now, I could be wrong, but it doesn't matter because perception's reality, right? So those are examples of pre-touch moments. The way in which we, and also the way in which advocates promote us, the way in which people rate us, the way in which we are promoted to customers, these are all those pre-touch moments that have a lot to do with what people think of us before they even engage us. The first touch moment is the trajectory moment. It's that moment that you go to a restaurant, for an example, and you open the door and it smells really, really good or really, really bad, right? These are very impactful because the 80% of the opinion that we're going to have of that product or brand oftentimes is set in cement in that first touch moment. As our mom always told us, first impressions last a lifetime. And for some brands, unfortunately, that's true. And for some brands, fortunately, that's true. So the pre-touch moment is heavily weighted, and that's why I talk about it in this five-touch point. So we got pre-touch, first touch, and then there's the all-important core touch. That's the day in and day out of what it's like to do to engage your product, brand, service, or technology. And again, it has to be constantly delivering above the customer's baseline level of expectation in both digital and non-digital channels. So if you have a product that, if you have a company that has a digital constituency and a physical constituency, those brands have to square up and they both have to deliver exquisite value. The last touch is really, really important. It's when you buy a jacuzzi from your local jacuzzi dealer and you've negotiated a really good deal and you feel good about what you've done, what you've purchased, and then they deliver the jacuzzi and then they knock on your door and they have four beautifully gift-wrapped boxes that are a thank you presents for everything that for doing business with them, and it's everything you will ever need. It's chlorine, it's brushes, it's spa scents, it's everything you'll ever need for that jacuzzi. And it's something that they didn't expect. That last touch moment, you punctuate it with shocking, delicious value. It works every time. In fact, I have encouraged my clients to build what I call a value bank. When you sell something, always put in the funds so that you can justifiably and predictably always deliver a beautiful, shocking surprise that they did not expect. And then the last touch point of this five-touch journey is what I call the in-touch moment. The in-touch isn't about jacking somebody's email and sending them propaganda so you can sell them more crap. It's really about maintaining an ongoing and realistic and fun dialogue where they're providing you stuff that you do not see under any circumstances of anything other than a real, real value. I bought my wife a Tiffany bracelet a few months ago, and out of the blue, you know, 8 weeks later, I get this beautiful envelope and a handwritten note saying, "Hey, listen, I just want to let you know, they also sent me one, the 3 or 4 days after I bought it for her. The person there had their card in there, and they said, "I just want to let you know that I really appreciate the opportunity to serve you. And look, if there's anything else I can do in the future." And then he mentioned a few things like, "Hey, I hope your trip to Australia went great. And boy, I love the fact that your wife just bought the new whatever car." You're right. So he remembered me. Now, could it be fake and could this be disingenuous? Maybe, but I'm egotistical enough to think he just thought I was really cool and just wanted to stay in touch, right? At least this guy is that good, right? So look, I mean, that's and how many people will do this? How many organizations are willing? From my research, I believe that the average large company and small company alike are losing 30% of revenue through deflection because they didn't They either had a fractional experience, their first, like a great example is you go in a restaurant, smells good, the outside property looks amazing, you have a great hostess, you sit down and you look at this incredible menu, the music is perfect, the temperature of the room is perfect, everything is perfect, and then your server comes up and she or he smells like cigarette smoke and is obviously having a big bad day, and he or she couldn't wait to spank somebody, and you're that somebody, right? There is nothing about the other touch points that will make up for, because as humans, we tend to focus on the lowest possible value. So anyway, that's a high level of what the five touch points are. And it sounds like a lot of work, but it's the least expensive way to grow businesses, to protect your business, to attract high quality employees, to improve your quality of work life. It does so many great things.
I love that last point too, about it being the least expensive way. You talk about innovation ideas, and I think that that's a key one that many of us on the marketing side of the business, you know, we're looking at everything as expenses to cut, and how we can minimize so many of these things. And especially when you talk about things that, you know, with the kind of bean counting glasses on, they may look at that perfect last touch point, the jacuzzi store, and be like, ah, do we really need to do, they've already bought from us, you know, maybe we, you know, there's all sorts of reasons not to do these things, I think. And I think that that's really dangerous.
It is in a time where there is unlimited places to buy everything for any quality level at any virtual price. So, you know, I talk about these four monster trends of the future. One of them is hyper consumerization, meaning that we're getting to a point where it's really tough to compete. And the ground zero of competition today is owning that human relationship. You know, we get so esoteric with all this stuff, but it's really about owning that human relationship. Look, in my practice, I can't tell you the weird stuff I see. I had a company call me up 2 weeks ago, large hospital chain, and they're saying, hey, look, we noticed that in addition to doing customer experience strategy, that you also do reputation management. So we want to find out if you can help us get these ratings offline. And I said, oh, that's not the way that we do reputation management. We realize that term, if you Google that term, it's really about SEO and digital witchcraft to try to push down bad ratings, right?
That's, yeah.
And I said, we have kind of an old-fashioned approach. We try to find out why you pissed these people off in the first place, right? And then we're going to make you better. And we're going to solve these things because they're – and I looked at their ratings and – you know, if anything, knowing because I understand their space really well, if anything, they were probably pretty easy on this particular hospital chain. So the point is that they'll spend money to try to fix brokenness, but they won't go to its core causality, and that's disturbing. We were asked to look at a huge LASIK practice surgery. This is doctors that do refractive surgery, huge practice. And for a regional practice, they had spent $2.7 million on an ad campaign, a lot of money for a regional doctor to spend, right? And they couldn't figure out why they had gotten no traction on this. So they reached out to us and we did our initial customer experience readiness audit. And we found that the gatekeeper at the practice was the meanest person I have ever met in my life. Like, I can remember saying out loud when I met her, I literally out loud go, yikes. You know, like, oops, did I just say that? Yeah. It was that bad. And you could see the people in this large waiting room of this beautiful practice going, really? So it's incredible how we will spend all kinds of money to get the business, but we won't do what is really necessary to perpetuate and grow the business at its most inexpensive and most sustainable level, and that is building a brand that is built on the pillars of customer experience mastery. That really does work.
Well said. Amen. Well, as we start to wrap up here, I have to ask, with all of the examples that you're looking at and all of these great stories, many of which we've heard, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
I'll tell you, you know, my poor family house, can you imagine, you know, living with somebody who sees everything critically?
Right.
Yeah. I look at everything and they're going, oh God, he's going to complain. He's going to complain. You know, they'll walk out to the car before we leave the restaurant. Right. I love IKEA, and it wasn't in my radar until about a week ago. And I hate to say it. Maybe it's because I'm a baby boomer. I have not hung out in IKEA. But I had a chance to, because my daughter, I have a senior in college who wanted to pick up a few things there. And I got to tell you, that place, I couldn't find anything to complain about, which is so bloody unusual for me. It was just cool people, super engaged, really. You know what? What's weird about customer experience is, if we can just find super cool, nice people, right, that are just good people, and we toss them in a building, pretty much you got it nailed, right? As long as you don't give them punitive policies. Their policies are great. Their brand is great. Their company is great. I did some research on them after that and saw that they had some issues on a recall or something, and the way in which they handled that was very authentic and honest. They make me smile, and I will definitely include them as a case example in my next book. I mentioned 20 brands in my book, but it's so nice to find another one pop up that I did not see on my radar.
Well, great policies, great people, and the other cool thing I found out researching them is that it's not just their people in their stores, it's through the rest of the supply chain, too, that they work to get everyone on the same page. That, again, is a lot of work, but definitely worth it if you can put that into it.
Yeah.
So where can we point folks to learn more about who you are and what you do?
So my consulting practice around customer experience, and also you can download a free chapter of What Customers Crave, is, not surprisingly, whatcustomerscrave.com. And on the speaking side of my life, that website is simply nickwebb2bs.com. And, you know, I'm always interested. I've had several people email me some great stories recently from other podcasts I've been involved in. I'm always interested in hearing what other people are up to. And they're always welcome to email me directly at simply nick@nickwebb.com. I'm always looking to learn from other people. So that's pretty much the best two sites, I think.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like there is some of that gregarious content and value to be found there as well. Awesome.
I hope so.
Well, thank you for joining us this week on Brand.
Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate it.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. Recently, Sean Carpenter gave us a shout out with some comments about our recent episode featuring naming expert Mike Pyle. Sean, thanks for listening. And a reminder, if you like something on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Links to everything are over at branddrivendigital.com. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. And remember, On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Order now at Amazon and check out Get Scrappy Book for special offers and extras. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.